Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ashley and I will bring you stories along with Anna Mateo and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, selected Canada, Mexico, and the United States to host the 2026 World Cup. On Wednesday, FIFA member countries voted 134-65 for the three nations over the other candidate, Morocco. The vote marks the first time that FIFA has accepted a three-nation bid for the soccer championship. The public vote took place in Moscow, where the 2018 soccer championship begins on Thursday. Football is known as soccer in the United States. The North American bid had to overcome concerns about the effects of policies of the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump. One such policy was a ban on travel from six majority Muslim countries for security reasons. Cameroon's representative to FIFA, Kevin Njomo, said the three-nation bid was strong, and if it was just the United States, Morocco would have beaten them. He added, "People have a soft spot for Mexico, especially looking at Mexico as a little bit underdeveloped and giving them a chance. Canada is a good tourist destination." The 2026 World Cup will also be the first to include 48 teams. The U.S. proposed hosting 60 out of the 80 games in 2026. Canada and Mexico would then host 10 games each. FIFA will have to decide how the games are divided up and which cities will be selected. FIFA will also decide on whether all three countries are guaranteed a place at the tournament. Both the United States and Canada failed to qualify for this year's World Cup. North American officials have promised to deliver $14 billion in revenue from the event. Preparation for the World Cup will not require major construction work, because the 16 stadiums where matches will be played already exist. Canada will host men's World Cup matches for the first time. Mexico last held the event in 1986, while the U.S. held the World Cup in 1994.
Turkey is busy preparing for elections later this month. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan hopes to be re-elected in the June 24th vote. Erdogan says the latest reports on the Turkish economy show his economic policies are working. Voters and international investors, however, are not so sure about the country's economic strength. The economy grew by 7.4% in the first 3 months of this year. That growth rate beat what many economists expected for the quarter. "We continue to be one of the fastest growing countries in the world," Erdogan said at an election campaign stop in Istanbul. Erdogan claimed victory against what he called conspirators, whom he blamed for a sharp drop in value of the Turkish lira. In May, the lira fell more than 10% as investors fled the Turkish market over concerns about high inflation and a growing current account deficit. Financial order returned after a sharp increase in interest rates, which helped the lira's value rise against other money.
But experts warn the strong growth will only fuel concerns that the government cannot continue to spend lots of money on public services. The current account deficit is more than 6% of GDP and inflation above 12%, Inan Demir of Nomura Holding noted on Monday. Demir, an economist, added that after the elections, the government must cut back on spending, or the value of the lira will fall again. A slowing economic policy usually means reduced government spending and higher interest rates. Turkey's strong economy has helped Erdogan and his AK party during their 16 years of electoral success. The economy has been expanding for over a year, but studies have found that many Turks are dissatisfied with the government's economic program. 51% of likely voters who were questioned said the economy was their major worry. The Metropole Research Service reported the finding. Last year, security problems were the number one concern among voters. Other studies found that a majority of voters blamed the government for their economic problems. "It's a liability for Erdogan," said Attila Yesilada of Global Source Partners. He noted that while employment has decreased, prices have risen. He also said no one is investing in new factories because interest rates on loans have topped 22%. Yesilada explained that the economic growth has not helped the people on the streets. So there is a lot of public anger. Turkey's unemployment rate remains about 10%. That information comes from the Turkish Statistical Institute.
In May, Erdogan announced retirees would receive two payments of over $200 timed to religious holidays. The first payment is set to go out this week. But Attila Yesilada warned that the money means little because of the financial pain caused by the increase in interest rates. "We all use loans. The middle class use loans to buy houses. Businesses use loans to expand. Even before the latest hikes, they were already at a 10-year high." "Banks have nearly stopped making new loans," Yesilada said. He added that a recession is likely. Candidates competing against Erdogan for the presidency talk about economic fears. "Erdogan can't survive this economic crisis," Muharrem İnce said during a recent campaign appearance in Istanbul. İnce is the presidential candidate of the CHP party. He said that Turkey is heading to dark days. "Don't be surprised if the Turkish lira hits 8 or 10 to the US dollar. When troubled days have come to countries around the world, they couldn't get through them unless they changed leaders." In May, at the start of the election campaign, the lira was less than 4 against the US dollar. It now stands at over 4.5. Its high was nearly 5 to the US dollar. Erdogan's public works projects are also a target in the election campaign. They include building one of the world's biggest airports and some of the longest bridges. The presidential candidate for the İyi Parti, Meral Akşener, said Turkey has the financial resources, but she thinks some officials are corrupt. She noted that the government built up a budget deficit of $453 billion in debt.
Google says it will no longer permit its artificial intelligence, or AI, technology to be used in any activities involving weapons. The company's chief executive officer, Sundar Pichai, announced the decision in an internet post. He wrote that the new policy was one of several newly launched principles aimed at guiding the company's AI work in the future. The principles are a set of ethical guidelines covering the company's development and sale of AI technology and tools. Google says it will no longer design or launch AI for weapons or other technologies whose main purpose is to cause harm to people. It will also not permit its AI technology to be used for surveillance activities that violate internationally accepted norms. We believe these principles are the right foundation for our company and the future development of AI, Pichai wrote. The principles were announced after more than 4,000 Google employees signed a document calling for the company to cancel an AI agreement with the U.S. Department of Defense. That agreement, known as Project Maven, involves the use of Google's AI technology to examine drone images for the U.S. military. A Google official recently told employees Project Maven would not be extended after it ends next year. Google is expected to discuss with military officials how to complete the project without violating its new principles. Kirk Hansen is director of the Markkula Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University in California. The center examines how ethics can be used to guide technology development. He told VOA the opposition by Google employees to the U.S. military agreement was based on fears that AI technology could lead to the creation of autonomous weapons.
If you have artificial intelligence which identifies targets and automatically launches weapons, you have what is known as an autonomous weapon. There is no human decision to launch the weapon.
Hansen said other companies could also face pressure from employees or the public if their AI technology is used to develop autonomous weapons. Just as with driverless vehicles, autonomous weapon systems may not be as safe as their supporters promise.
We should be more concerned about how an autonomous weapon might make a mistake. Is that artificial intelligence targeting system as good as we think it is? And until we have trust that those systems will not make mistakes, we're going to have a lot of doubts about the use of artificial intelligence.
Hansen says even though Project Maven does not directly use Google AI to power autonomous weapons, AI systems do help with military targeting.
If you have better targeting, presumably that's a good thing. But the critics say if you have better targeting, it raises your level of confidence in the targeting, which may lead you to then apply independent, autonomous decision-making by machine, which will launch the weapons.
A top Department of Defense official was asked about the use of autonomous weapons during an event last year at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Air Force General Paul J. Selva, Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said such systems should never be used to replace human commanders. Google Chief Pichai said the company does not plan to stop providing AI technology for all military uses. He said Google will still seek government projects in areas such as military training, internet security, and search and rescue. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Americans experimented with many new customs and social traditions during the 1920s. There were new dances, new kinds of clothes, and some of the most imaginative art and writing ever produced in the United States. But in most ways, the 1920s were a conservative time in American life. Voters elected three conservative Republican presidents: Warren Harding, Calvin Coolidge, and Herbert Hoover. And they supported many conservative social and political policies. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe continue the story of American conservatism during the 1920s.
One such policy concerned immigration. Most Americans in the 1920s had at least some ties through blood or marriage to the first Americans who came from Britain. Many people with these kinds of historic ties considered themselves to be real Americans, true Americans. Americans traditionally had welcomed newcomers from such Western European countries as Britain, France, or Germany. But most of the people arriving in New York City and other harbors in the 1920s were from the central, eastern, and southern areas of Europe. Some Americans became afraid of these millions of people arriving at their shores. They worried that the immigrant newcomers might steal their jobs, or they feared the political beliefs of the immigrants.
Pressure to control immigration increased following the World War. Congress passed a bill that set a limit on how many people would be allowed to enter from each foreign country. And the Congress and President Calvin Coolidge agreed to an even stronger immigration law in 1924. Under the new law, limits on the number of immigrants from each foreign country depended on the number of Americans who had families in that country. For example, the law allowed many immigrants to enter from Britain or France because many American citizens had families in those countries. But fewer people could come from Italy or Russia because fewer Americans had family members in those countries. The laws were very difficult to enforce, but they did succeed in limiting the number of immigrants from certain countries.
A second sign of the conservative feelings in the 1920s was the nation's effort to ban the sale of alcoholic drinks or liquor. This policy was known as prohibition because it prohibited or banned alcoholic drinks. Many of the strongest supporters of prohibition were conservative Americans living in rural areas. Many of them believed that liquor was evil, the product of the devil. A number of towns and states passed laws banning alcohol sales during the first years of the 20th century. And in 1919, the nation passed the 18th Amendment to the Federal Constitution. This amendment and the Volstead Act made it unlawful to make, sell, or transport liquor.
Prohibition laws failed terribly from the start. There was only a small force of police to enforce the new laws, and millions of Americans still wanted to drink liquor. It was not possible for the police to watch every American who wanted to buy a drink secretly or make liquor in his own home. Not surprisingly, thousands of Americans soon saw a chance to make profits from the new laws. They began to import liquor illegally to sell for high prices. Criminals began to bring liquor across the long unprotected border with Canada or on fast boats from the Caribbean islands. At the same time, private manufacturers in both cities and rural areas began to produce liquor, and shop owners in cities across the country sold liquor with little interference from local police. By the middle of the 1920s, it was clear to most Americans that prohibition laws were a failure. But the laws were not changed until the election of President Franklin Roosevelt in 1932.
A third sign of conservatism in the 1920s was the effort by some Americans to ban school books on modern science. Most of the Americans who supported these efforts were conservative rural Americans who believed in the traditional ideas of the Protestant Christian Church. Many of them were fearful of the many changes that had taken place in American society. Science became an enemy to many of these traditional religious Americans. Science seemed to challenge the most basic ideas taught in the Bible. The conflict burst into a major public debate in 1925 in a trial over Charles Darwin's idea of evolution.
British scientist Charles Darwin published his books, The Origin of the Species and The Descent of Man, in the 19th century. The books explained Darwin's idea that humans developed over millions of years from apes and other animals. Most Europeans and educated people accepted Darwin's theory by the end of the 19th century. But the book had little effect in rural parts of the United States until the 1920s. William Jennings Bryan led the attack on Darwin's ideas. Bryan was a rural Democrat who ran twice for president. He lost both times. But Bryan remained popular among many traditional Americans. Bryan told his followers that the theory of evolution was evil because it challenged the traditional idea that God created the world in 6 days. He accused scientists of violating God's words in the Bible. Bryan and his supporters called on local school officials to ban the teaching of evolution. Some state legislatures in the more conservative southeastern part of the country passed laws making it a crime to teach evolution theory.
In 1925, a young science teacher in the southern state of Tennessee challenged the state's new teaching law. The teacher, John Scopes, taught Darwin's evolution ideas. Officials arrested Scopes and put him on trial. Some of the nation's greatest lawyers rushed to Tennessee to defend the young teacher. They believed the state had violated his right to free speech. And they thought Tennessee's law against teaching evolution was foolish in a modern scientific society. America's most famous lawyer, Clarence Darrow, became the leader of Scopes' defense team. Bryan and other religious conservatives also rushed to the trial. They supported the right of the state of Tennessee to ban the teaching of evolution. The trial was held in the small town of Dayton, Tennessee. Hundreds of people came to watch. Religious conservatives, free speech supporters, newsmen, and others. The high point of the trial came when Bryan himself sat before the court. Lawyer Clarence Darrow asked Bryan question after question about the Bible and about science. How did Bryan know the Bible is true? Did God really create the earth in a single day? Is a day in the Bible 24 hours, or can it mean a million years?
Bryan answered the questions, but he showed a great lack of knowledge about modern science. The judge found Scopes guilty of breaking the law. But in the battle of ideas, science defeated conservatism. And a higher court later ruled that Scopes was not guilty. The Scopes evolution trial captured the imagination of Americans. The issue was not really whether one young teacher was innocent or guilty of breaking a law. The real question was the struggle for America's spirit between the forces of modern ideas and those of traditional rural conservatism. The trial represented this larger conflict.
American society was changing in many important ways during the early part of the 20th century. It was not yet the world superpower that it would become after World War II, but neither was it a traditional rural society of conservative farmers and clergy. The 1920s were a period of growth, of change, and of struggle between the old and new values.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.